Visitors to Atlanta's new Center for Civil and Human Rights are finding just how emotional it can be to revisit the struggle for equal rights for blacks.
I get teary-eyed, I get choked up a little bit.
I'll talk to the center's CEO, Doug Shipman, and take you on a tour of Georgia's newest attraction.
There have been some laboratory experiments that shows that memory in bees is diminished when exposed to sublethal levels of pesticides. And so bees need to remember where their hives are.
Honeybees are disappearing like characters in a J.J. Abrams TV drama. But researchers at Georgia Tech and Georgia State are working to find a solution to a problem that has enormous economic implications. Atlanta has just been named the fifth happiest city in the United States. I'll ask humorist Rob Cleveland what we need to do to get to number one. I'm Bill Nigut. Those stories coming up on Two-Way Street. Welcome to Two-Way Street. I'm Bill Nigut. Atlanta's National Center for Civil and Human Rights has been open for about a month now. The vision for the center began during the tenure of Atlanta Mayor Shirley Franklin. She shared the belief of many that since this is the home of the civil rights movement, Atlanta ought to have a place where the story of the fight for equal rights for black Americans could be told. Although it was hard to find people who didn't think the center was a good idea, fundraising became a serious challenge when the recession hit in 2007, and there were days when even the strongest advocates worried that the center might never be built. But those who believed in it most refused to stop working to make the center a reality, and no one worked harder than the center CEO Doug Shipman. Shipman started as a pro bono consultant on the project, but his passion for the center led him to leave his consulting company and go to work full-time overseeing fundraising, program development, and building of the center. Recently, I interviewed Doug Shipman in our studios and then took a recorder to the center to capture impressions of what the experience of visiting is like. Here's the story. It's a dreary, overcast morning in downtown Atlanta. About 100 people are standing on a plaza bordered by the World of Coca-Cola on one side and the Georgia Aquarium on the other. But this crowd is waiting for the doors to open at the National Center for Civil and Human Rights. There's a group of middle school students and a group of older ladies. On this day, most of the queuing visitors are African American. As they enter the first gallery, the visitors are confronted with banks of 1950s-era TV sets. Each tuned to old news footage of white Southern political leaders espousing the values of segregation.
And I say segregation now, segregation tomorrow, and segregation forever.
I have no doubt that the Negro basically knows that the best friend he's ever had in the world is a Southern white man.
I have made my position in this matter crystal clear. I have said in every county in Mississippi that no school in our state will be integrated on our new government.
For many visitors like Deborah Britt from Zebulon, Georgia, this gallery is like a shock treatment.
I was just telling my co-workers, it's about 15 of us here today, and I was just telling them I'm getting teary-eyed, I'm getting choked up a little bit, looking and listening.
The center tells stories of the good days and the bad days in the civil rights struggles. But as CEO Doug Shipman told me when I interviewed him recently, city leaders felt it was crucial that Atlanta, the home of the civil rights movement, have a place to tell that story.
Well, this started from the civil rights icons coming to Mayor Shirley Franklin of Atlanta and saying, we need an institution that talks about the whole history of the civil rights movement, including students and the Jewish community, Atlanta's special role, and connects it to contemporary issues around the world that are happening today. Civil rights, in just the popular mind, I think, is really a moniker for African-American freedom struggle, 60s, 50s, Martin Luther King Jr. Human rights is usually international. You think of genocide, you think of war, et cetera. We wanted both titles so that we weren't confusing anyone, that we weren't doing the other one. Civil rights, strictly speaking, are the rights you have under the law. Human rights are the rights you have no matter whether or not you're a citizen or not. So technically speaking, civil rights are part of human rights.
And it's fair to say, I think, that one of the important efforts that you make is to weave these two themes together. Yes?
That's exactly right. One gallery we have is the Morehouse College King Papers Collection, which is displaying parts of the 13,000 document collection of Dr. King's life. sermons, speeches, letters, but we really showcase those that connect King's thoughts to the world, that connect King's thoughts to other issues. In the Civil Rights series of galleries, that is really oriented towards the people and the way in which the Civil Rights Movement happened, so that people today who didn't live through it can connect to it. And then the Human Rights Galleries really showcase issues from around the world. We talk about issues of women overseas. We talk about bullying here in the United States. We talk about issues like human trafficking that go across the spectrum of geography. And so we are trying to weave together these issues.
In the earliest days, when Mayor Shirley Franklin at the time was talking about this, when it was just a vision, a dream, she often called it a museum. You're not calling it a museum. Why?
Well, we just wanted to make sure that folks understood that, one, it was contemporary. It wasn't just about history. If you said Civil Rights Museum, and there are great civil rights museums, but they very much focus on the past. We wanted to make sure that people understood that we had a future-oriented aspect as well. So we wanted Center has a feel as if, one, it's continuing to change, and also that there's a lot of activity happening.
I think one of the things that excites me here is, as a Chicagoan who watched the civil rights movement from a distance in the 60s, when I moved to Atlanta in the mid-80s, suddenly those iconic leaders who I had admired so greatly from a distance were people in my own community. You could get to know Joseph Lowery. You got to know Andrew Young and then Hosea Williams. That heritage and the fact that those great leaders were part of our everyday life here in Atlanta is really a remarkable heritage for us to keep in mind, isn't it?
It's an incredible heritage. I mean, there are two Nobel Peace Prize winners within a mile of each other institutionally. There are two Presidential Medal of Freedom winners that literally are neighbors between C.T. Vivian and John Lewis. There are icons walking around all the time. And I think that they wanted, when they approached Shirley Franklin, they wanted a place that people who did not know them would be able to be inspired by them. And one thing that many people forget is that they went on, all the people you named, went on past the 60s and worked on the anti-apartheid movement and worked on the women's rights movement and worked on the farm workers movement and worked on the gay rights movement. And so they, I think, also wanted their stories to be fully told in a way that would inspire.
The story is that it was the wives of two of those leaders, Evelyn Lowery and Juanita Abernathy, who actually first approached Mayor Franklin to suggest this. It certainly wouldn't have been the first time people talked about a civil rights center of some sort, but apparently they were inspirational in getting the mayor to move on this, yes?
That's exactly right. Mayor Franklin had come to office. Lots of people came to see her with lists, and they said, we think that this is important. To her credit, she said two things. She said, one, I'm willing to put it on the list. And two, she said, we're going to have to get others involved to make it happen. This can't just be about people who were there, but in order for it to actually have a long-term legacy, we have to get other kinds of people and, frankly, younger people involved. And so, you know, calling on me, calling on A.J. Robinson, who is at Central Atlanta Progress, a business leader, calling on academics around the city, she immediately was willing to bring in other voices to say, how can we make the best of this great idea?
One of the first issues that she had to tackle head on was the concerns of people in the Auburn Avenue neighborhood about the fact that this center might not, at that point, be located in their community. And there was a great deal of concern about that in those days. It's a concern that you had to take on when you stepped into your role as well. How did you reconcile that? How has that worked?
So, of course, Auburn Avenue is a historically very important African-American district. At one end is the King District, where the King Center resides, as well as Old Ebenezer and the King Birth Home. And it's a neighborhood that has fallen into economic despair. There's really a lot of buildings without use. And so the desire was twofold. One, that we should not take the history that happened on Auburn and Auburn not benefit from it if we're going to build an institution. And two, Auburn needed help. When I first got on the job in 2007 full-time, I had 125 sessions with people, almost exclusively about this issue. And my question was, what do you really want? And they said, we really want Auburn to benefit. And we think that it will benefit if you locate the center there. Well, actually, if you look at it, cultural institutions can't turn around neighborhoods. Cultural institutions usually follow after a neighborhood starts to turn around. So one thing that we did, I spent a lot of time on, was the streetcar, to get the streetcar to go down Auburn, because that is a tool that can redevelop a neighborhood. And the other was to form relationships with Auburn Avenue Research Library, with the King Center, with others, and to have Auburn Avenue in our exhibitions. So actually, when you see the exhibitions, there's a whole large exhibition on Auburn Avenue to try to entice people to go there and to understand its legacy and also to engage it today. But at the end of the day, this institution needed to be where the people are who want to visit a place, and also in a place that was unexpected. And at the end of the day, the land that Koch donated put us not only at the front door of the aquarium in the World of Koch, but put us right beside the Centennial Olympic Park, which gives it the international legacy that I think is so important.
Let's talk just for a couple minutes. Let's give people a tour of what they will see when they arrive at the center. Of course, you're going to have the King papers on display in rotation. I think every 3 months you'll trade out the papers. Are there some papers in the first exhibit that we would want to pay particular attention to?
Well, yes, there's not only papers, but there are a couple of objects. There is the Drum Major Instinct handwritten speech. This is the speech that he gave about 3 months before he was killed and said that he wanted to be his eulogy, and in fact it was played at his funeral. The draft is actually written not on regular paper, but on kind of sheets of scrap paper from a hotel, front and back. So it's, you get to see that King was always writing. Andy Young said he scribbled on everything, including sometimes toilet paper. I mean, it was just writing all the time. We also have the suitcase that he carried when he was assassinated and some of the contents. So you get to see what cologne he used. You get to see his comb, very personal artifacts.
What cologne did he use?
He used Aramaeus, actually. Okay. We go all the way back. We have some books from when he was a student. So you get to see him very early on in the development of his thinking, some of his very earliest sermons. You can read them, and you start to see that beginning of that poetry that you will hear later on. But the one thing you won't is hear his voice in that gallery. We wanted folks to really commune with the material and not just be lulled by his voice. You hear his voice elsewhere, but not in that gallery.
Is Letter from Birmingham Jail part of this collection?
Letter from Birmingham Jail draft is part of this collection. We have an exhibition actually in the Civil Rights Galleries about Letter from Birmingham Jail, where we bring it to life. And we also have the draft of it in which he edited. But the real Letter from Birmingham Jail was written on newspapers that were thrown away as soon as they were transcribed by his secretary.
Tell us about what else. What will our tour show us?
So actually outside there's a very large water feature with a quote from Margaret Mead and a quote from Nelson Mandela that you can walk under. So even as you approach the building, the storytelling greets you. There are two large art pieces in the lobby, one from Paula Scheer, a graphic art piece around protest posters, and then a series of photographs by the photographer Platon, who shoots for Vanity Fair, of human rights activists from around the world. The Civil Rights series of galleries really transport you to the Civil Rights era. George C. Wolfe, who is a theater director, has won a couple of Tonys, really creates a play that you walk through. And so you confront the Freedom Rides, and you see the Freedom Riders in a bus-like theater. You can sit at a lunch counter and you can hear audio that transports you to what it would have felt like to sit there.
Several visitors are sitting at the simulated lunch counter that recreates the experience of students who sat in to integrate cafeterias in Atlanta and elsewhere. They wear earphones and listen to a crowd of angry people screaming at them. Their seats vibrate as they're kicked at and pushed by the crowd. Loretta Mayfield from Jackson, Georgia. What was that experience like?
Oh, it was terrifying.
What did you hear?
Foul language and aggression, anger, all of it.
What were people screaming? What did they want?
They wanted them to leave, to get up and leave.
It's scary?
Very scary.
Can you imagine putting yourself in the place of those demonstrators who sat in?
No.
Jackie Greer was terrified. What did you just experience?
Something terrible. It was terrible.
Where were you sitting?
Over at the counter.
Lunch counter?
The lunch counter, yep.
What were you hearing?
A lot of beating and noise and profanities. And it was just... it was terrible.
Could you imagine yourself actually being involved in that sit-in?
Yeah, but that's something I wouldn't want to be in anymore. I wouldn't be able to take it.
You were glad to be able to get up.
Yep.
We will use the dogs if we start drawing knives again, drawing rocks. We will use the holes if it becomes necessary. to stop the march.
Next to the lunch counter, we see news film of marchers in Birmingham, Alabama, being set upon by police under the direction of the notorious Bull Connor.
After seeing Bull Connor make that statement, we're now looking at pictures of police dogs, snarling police dogs, on tight leashes, going after demonstrators. And now firemen using water hoses to drive back the demonstrators from City Street. We see images now of police officers grabbing at demonstrators, dragging them to paddy wagons to be arrested.
The videos show a little bit of what happened when those hoses went on. You may have seen it on TV during the time of Martin Luther King's birthday, etc. We're going to get together and move toward the transition, the greatest, one of the most joyful events that ever took place in the civil rights movement was indeed the March on Washington. All is very important to see and to look at. So let's walk in and take a look at what happened in 1963 and get a sense of what it felt like to come together to fight for civil rights as a body.
You see a film on the March on Washington in a space that feels like it. We have a space that talks about the King funeral in Atlanta, and you can see a film that has never been seen before, really a home movie of the entire King funeral.
Are you a volunteer guide?
I am a volunteer guide with this center.
Why do you want to do this?
I'm a native Atlantan. I think this is a fabulous center for the city of Atlanta, and I hope it's a way that I can give back to the city that I love and that I know about. And I lived through much of this time. I was in college and was at the funeral, actually, of when Martin Luther King was brought down with the old Hunter Street. So I know exactly how it feels to be a part of history, and I want these young people to feel that same way.
Among those learning more about the movement, we come across Alan and Luke Holmes, father and son from Greensboro, North Carolina.
I wanted Luke and I both to, you know, just to understand the civil rights movement and what we've gone through as a country for freedom, equality.
It is, in a way, it's depressing because you see all these people that are, they're people just like you and me. I mean, whites and blacks are not any different. They're all people, and just seeing them being treated like this is terrible. But it's also good and good to know that we are equal, and we know that today.
And then you ascend to the third floor. All of that's on the second floor, and that is the human rights space. Very bright, very open, where you meet people and issues around human rights. And so there are interactive technologies where you can literally find people who talk to you through a mirror about their confronting of human rights issues. We have interactive tables where you can go deeply on issues. And I think most importantly, we have stories of individual people today who are fighting for human rights all over the world.
And that's where we find 13-year-old middle school student Imani.
What do you feel when you come into this room?
Happy. Like, it makes them, it's really cool. Especially, like, the music is theming with them. And I like how the people are talking. And I see, like, different races fighting for rights. So it's really cool. So it actually makes it seem like it's not just us that's fighting for rights. It's actually everybody else.
Whether it be disability rights in the U.S. or whether it be medical rights in Africa, you meet these incredible individuals who show such courage. Then we also talk about, for instance, the issue of violence against women, which many call a pandemic. And many are studying violence against women in societies as a human, as a health rights crisis. And so we also try to, in some ways, blur the lines between things so that visitors say, gosh, I know a lot about this, but I don't know a lot about that. Here are the similarities. Here are the differences. Oh, I've read about what's happening in Syria, but I don't really know the context. So we try to give them, we call it, we want every visitor to have an itch that they scratch later. So it's not just about what happens in our facility and the time that you're with us, but it also gives you an appetite to go further on the issues that interest you most.
If you had to choose one thing that you learned that surprised you most as you started putting this together from the history of the movement, can you identify what that might be?
Yeah, that's actually quite easy. I've been very fortunate to get to know a lot of the civil rights icons and to study a lot of the history, actually, all the way back to my college days. The hopefulness that people who are on the front lines of civil rights history and also of human rights issues, the hopefulness that they maintain in the face of the worst of humanity, and being able to get up every day and not only keep going, but to believe that the people they're working against will someday see the light and be reconciled back to better, to be better, is stunning. And it's a pervasive thing among activists. There's something about them that they can keep going with the faith that not only is the world going to get better, but the people who they're confronting are actually not as bad as they're behaving today. And that faith in humanity in the face of the counter data is just amazing to me.
Doug Shipman is the CEO of Atlanta's National Center for Civil and Human Rights. I spoke with him in our studios recently. The rest of the sound you heard in this piece, I gathered at the center during a visit this past week. If you'd like more information about the Center for Civil and Human Rights, go to gpb.org and click on Two-Way Street. There'll be a link to the center there. We have more ahead on Two-Way Street. I'm Bill Nygut. Now here's the sound of the season. Swarming honeybees lighting upon a patch of wildflowers under the baking sun on a lazy afternoon in July. A day when there's no escape from the languid, hypnotic spell the heat and the fragrance of the flowers and the buzzing of the bees casts over you as you while away another endless day of summer. But all is not well in the world of the honeybee. Over the past 7 or 8 years, they've been dying off or disappearing at alarming rates. Since 2007, an average of 30% of all colonies have died every winter in the United States. This loss is about twice as high as what U.S. beekeepers consider economically tolerable. Bees play a crucial role in the U.S. food economy. And the problem is so serious that last month, President Obama appointed a honeybee task force to address the issue of the rapidly diminishing pollinator population. There are many theories about why the bees are dying, and research is going on all over the country to find answers. Here in Georgia, Georgia Tech and Georgia State University are now working together to find remedies that will keep honeybees alive and thriving. Recently, I invited two of those researchers to talk about this problem and the search for solutions. Jennifer Levy teaches in the biology department at Georgia Tech. Chris Cornelison is a postdoctoral researcher at Georgia State. Why are honeybees so important to us?
Well, honeybees and bees in general pollinate many of the foods that we eat. You don't get good yields of any kind of fruit or nut or vegetables like squash, tomatoes, things like that that are actually fruits, but require pollination of their flowers to set fruit. So the estimates are that 30% of our food comes from plants that are pollinated by bees.
And there's an enormous economic impact in all of this if the honeybee population is dying off.
Well, one of the USDA figures is that honeybees contribute $15 billion a year in added crop value in the United States as pollinators. And there's some crops that are almost exclusively pollinated by bees. Almonds are one of the famous crops that need a significant honeybee pollination. And then closer to home in Georgia, onions, Vidaea onions, are 90% pollinated by, or 100% pollinated by insects. 90% of those insects are honeybees. So tremendous amount of onion pollination is dependent upon honeybee activity.
And what's been happening to the honeybee population?
Well, since about 2006, commercial beekeepers and backyard beekeepers have noticed that there have been declines in the numbers of bees and increases in the number of colony deaths over the winter. So on average, there's about a 15% colony loss each year. And starting in about 2006, there was about a 30% colony loss. And a lot of beekeepers were noticing that it was a phenomenon called colony collapse disorder. That was what they were describing it as, which is when you open up the beehives, all the worker bees, the adult bees, are gone. And they would leave their developing bees, their brood, as it were, in the hive, and leave their honey stores, and sometimes even leave the queen, which is particularly alarming. So that was a mystery, and still is kind of a mystery why it's happening. And there are probably a combination of factors that have led to colony collapse disorder. But the doubling of loss of colonies every year is what was so alarming.
It's particularly interesting, it seems to me, in that respect, to note that the bodies of those missing bees are not discoverable anywhere. It isn't
right.
as if you've been able to autopsy the dead bees to know what's happened
right.
to them,
they're
correct?
Right, they're vanished, mm-hmm. yeah. Mm-hmm.
They're just gone.
Right.
Like a J.J. Abrams TV series. I mean,
exactly.
seriously. Yeah, I know that. I don't mean to be facetious, but that it is a mystery, I suspect.
But that's what makes it so challenging, is that without the bodies or the bees there, it's hard to understand what happened to them. So if you don't have any bees there with that you can say, okay, this is clearly a disease state or something like that, then it makes it even more challenging to understand exactly why this is occurring. And there's a tremendous amount of research all over the country and really globally into colony collapse disorder.
Without a body, how do you possibly detect what is happening?
Well, one of the kind of, if you look at the literature of what's been published about studies on CCD.
CCD, oh, colony
collapse
disorder.
Yeah, sorry about that. So they'll look at a series of hives, and UGA has a very active bee program, and they have a large amount of hives, and they'll look at the quality of the bees going into the winter season and then see, you know, what hives they end up losing. Did those hives, were they carrying veromites?
What are veromites?
Veromites are an invasive species of mite that was introduced into the United States that will colonize the hive, and it transmits a virus that causes genetic defects in the adult wing formation. And eventually you get a larger and larger subpopulation with genetic defects in the wings. And if you're a flying insect and you have mm-hmm. genetic defects in your wings, you're not going to be very effective.
But Jennifer, we do have some belief now that pesticides have played a fairly significant role in this. Yes?
Yes. Well, pesticides are certainly detectable in beehives. Even in beehives that where all of the wax is virgin wax, it's just been produced by the bees, there are detectable pesticide levels. And one of the most interesting things that have come out recently is that it's not necessarily acute toxicity that's killing the bees, right? So pesticides can be acutely toxic to bees. They can just flat out die when they're exposed. Or there can be sublethal effects, so changes in the behavior of the bees as a result, or the development of the bees as a result of pesticide exposure. So these smaller quantities of pesticides that can accumulate in the wax or can accumulate in the honey or the pollen. Pollen is a primary contributor to pesticide contamination in the hive. Those can cause bees to have reduced ability to remember things. There have been some laboratory experiments that shows that memory in bees is diminished when exposed to sublethal levels of pesticides. And so bees need to remember where their hives are, right? So if they leave and go forage and can't find their way back or can't remember where their hives are, you will lose those populations of worker bees that are so important for bringing back food to the rest of the colony.
So in your studies and the work you're doing at Georgia Tech, is it pesticides that you're focused on primarily, or are you looking at other conditions?
We are certainly interested in pesticides because it has been found that pesticide levels are higher in urban areas than in rural areas. You would think that in agricultural regions that have widespread crop dusting, pesticide application in those methods might have higher levels of pesticides, but it's actually, you know, the termite application people use on their homes that contributes. Certainly, people don't like creepy crawly insects in their homes, and so spraying for mosquitoes in your backyard. All of these types of pesticide applications can contribute to increased levels in our streams and in our yards and on plants that bees forage on.
Right. And how are you picking up on this research, and what's your direction with this at Georgia State?
So at Georgia State, really, we're looking for benign, biologically based treatment options, because currently there are chemically based treatment options for a lot of the diseases that we're investigating. However, it has been shown that some of those treatments, primarily the antifungal chemicals, have these kind of behavioral impacts and health impacts on the bees themselves that may leave them more susceptible to other diseases. Also, it renders the honey, in certain cases, inedible for human consumption. So now, as a beekeeper, you have to choose either I treat my hive with this fungicide and I can no longer take my honey to market, just use them for pollination, or I just let it go.
So again, I want to go back to the economic impact of all this. We talked about how honeybee pollination has an impact on the economy, but the honey industry itself, if you're using the wrong treatments, can be severely impacted by this as well.
Right. So I'm not familiar with any exact economic figures on honey, but it is a significant source of income for beekeepers. I mean, they basically have two kind of business models. You can use them for industrial pollination, or you can use them for honey production. And the ideal scenario is both, right? And that's what we're trying to avoid, forcing beekeepers to make a choice with their treatment options. And we think that some of the treatments we're investigating have real promise in providing both the benefit of preventing the disease and not adulterating the honey.
Are there many beekeepers in the city of Atlanta or the metro area?
There are. It's really widespread. So inside the perimeter, there's a very large and active beekeeping organization called the Metro Atlanta Beekeepers Association. And they have meetings once a month, and they run a one-day short course in January for anybody who's interested in learning how to keep bees and wants to keep bees in their backyard. So that's a very active group, but there are beekeeping clubs all around the metro area as well. I think a lot of people who get into beekeeping are gardeners, right? So they have small vegetable gardens in their backyard and are interested in increasing the productivity of those gardens. So that's one population. There are also people who are just love bugs. They love insects, and they want to keep bees. And then there are people who want, you can make a pretty good supplemental income keeping a few hives in your backyard, because there's certainly a market for local raw honey. There's a good immunological basis for reducing seasonal allergies by consuming pollen by an oral route. So a lot of people think that eating local honey reduces the severity of their allergies.
Well, I've seen the video of both of you that's on your website, Chris, showing you with Jennifer at least at the hive that you've been keeping. So you now both are actually beepers, is that right?
I just fake it for the filming. Yeah, she's the legitimate beekeeper.
You really are into honeybees, aren't you?
Yes, I am recently very, very into honeybees. We have currently six hives on the roof of the Clough Commons building at Georgia Tech. I have two hives at home in my backyard. My parents have two hives at their farm out in Alabama, and we have hives placed at two community gardens, Georgia Tech beehives that are placed at two community gardens, one on the west side and one in South DeKalb.
What did you have to learn to become a beekeeper about how you go about that business?
For me, I had to learn how not to get stung, because I'm pretty sensitive to bee stings.
How do you not get stung?
Just wear all the appropriate equipment. Every time I try to leave something out, like socks or gloves, I always get stung.
So there are a lot of people who are afraid of bees because of this.
Oh.
You have to overcome a fear.
Well, you're likely to get stung if you open up the roof of a beehive and start pulling the bees out. but the risk of getting stung is very low if you leave the beehive alone. So just this morning, I was out on the roof taking pictures, and I got right next to the beehive with no protective equipment on at all. Honeybees are not aggressive. They will, you know, defend their hive if you're messing with it. But you can get pretty close to a closed beehive, and if you're looking non-threatening, if you don't look like a bear, it's unlikely that you'll get stung.
As opposed to, say, a yellow jacket, which is a much more aggressive kind of bee, is that right?
Wasps are more aggressive. Yellow jackets, you know, they can sting multiple times, and they're also ground nesters. So most people who complain of getting stung by yellow jackets tend to complain in the fall when they're mowing their lawns, and fall is sort of the peak of the colony size. Yellow jackets, only the queens survive the winter, and then they make a new nest, and they lay a lot of eggs in the spring, and so all summer long, the size of their colonies are increasing, and by the fall, when you mow your lawn, there's a lot of yellow jackets who can come out and sting you. But,
The vibration, I know that from mowing some lawns growing up, the vibration.
I ask that because what I'm leading to is, in the meantime, are we continuing to lose large percentages of the honeybee population?
It depends year to year. So this past year, the colony losses were fewer than they had been in previous years. I think the most important thing to consider are just, you know, how are we impacting the environment?
Of the mower will get them agitated. And it's also interesting to note that the wasp and yellow jackets are essentially carnivorous. They eat other bugs, whereas honeybees forage on plant material pollen. And I don't know if that necessarily plays a role in their aggressiveness or not, but it certainly is why they have evolved the ability to sting multiple times without dying, because that's how they subdue their prey.
So let me go back to the project that you're involved with, the research you're doing. If all goes well, eventually you want to go to market with whatever you've come up with as a preventative. I ask that because what I'm leading to is, in the meantime, are we continuing to lose large percentages of the honeybee population?
It depends year to year. So this past year, the colony losses were fewer than they had been in previous years. I think the most important thing to consider are just, you know, how are we impacting the environment?
Jennifer Levy teaches in the biology department at Georgia Tech. Chris Cornelison is a postdoctoral researcher at Georgia State. They're cooperating on research to determine the cause of and a cure for collapsed colony disorder, which is killing honeybees at alarming rates. What is it about bees anyway? They're not like cats and dogs. We don't give them names. They can't play fetch. And you won't find videos of adorable bees on YouTube. And yet there's something about them that we seem to find fascinating. Bees have held a mysterious sway in folklore and popular customs for centuries. One of the most curious customs relating to honeybees is what the British call telling the bees. Beekeepers across Britain have believed for hundreds of years that it's important to tell their bees about important events in the keepers' lives. It's especially important to report to the bees about deaths in the family. If the bees aren't told, superstition has it that they may fly away or stop producing honey. To inform the bees about a death in the family, the keeper might wrap the hive in black cloth or knock on the hive and announce to the bees what's happened. A number of poems have been written about this strange custom. Here's one by Eugene Field. "Oh, gentle bees, I've come to say that grandfather fell asleep today. And we know by the smile on grandfather's face, he has found his dear one's biding place. So bees, sing soft and bees, sing low, as over the honey fields you sweep. To the trees a bloom and the flowers a blow, sing of grandfather fast asleep. And ever beneath these orchard trees, find cheer and shelter, gentle bees." Telling the Bees by Eugene Field. This is Two Way Street. We'll be right back. We'll be right back.
Let me tell you about the birds and the bees and the flowers and the trees, the moon up above, and a thing called love.
Welcome back to Two-Way Street. A study out this week purports to reveal the happiest and unhappiest cities in the United States. Yes, Atlanta is on the list, but so are some surprising choices. I couldn't think of anyone better to chew over this data with than Atlanta comedian and storyteller Rob Cleveland. Rob, we have just looked at a study that was done by researchers at the University of British Columbia and Harvard.
Ah, okay.
Well, so you know.
So it must be good.
Oh, it must be serious.
Canada and Harvard?
Yeah.
Together?
Yeah, I mean, if you told me, if you said just British Columbia, might have said.
No, you can't take that.
But this is Harvard.
And
Rob.
British Columbia.
They've picked the happiest 10 cities in the United States.
Okay.
And the unhappiest 10 cities in the United States. And they say they've done it by using research from the Centers for Disease Control.
And which is always a good barometer of happiness. Anybody seen my anthrax? It's in a little Tupperware. It's got little... Oh, okay, well, what's the worst that could happen? How do you lose the last... That's the last smallpox on the planet, and I swear you put it. It's always the last place you look. Okay?
I knew if I mentioned Centers for Disease Control, I was going to get you going. That happens to be off topic.
Okay, I'm so sorry. We'll stay on topic.
I wanted to look. Here are the 10 happiest cities.
Okay.
In the United States: Richmond, Petersburg, Virginia.
Okay.
Norfolk, Virginia Beach, Newport News.
It's a lovely city. I've been there. It's very nice.
Washington, D.C.
I don't understand that one.
Four is Raleigh-Durham.
Okay, lots of smokers. That's good.
Five, Atlanta, Georgia. Now, Rob, here's my big starting question for you.
Okay, we're number five of the happiest cities.
We're five of the happiest cities. They're saying, this is Harvard University, remember.
Mm-hmm.
They know what they're talking about
at
Harvard.
Well, okay.
How could we possibly be less happy than the people in Washington, D.C.?
I don't get the Washington, D.C. one. I mean, I'll give you Norfolk because it's got a beach. I'll give you Richmond. It's got, like, old stuff. Have you ever walked around Washington, D.C.? Those are not happy people. You got a whole city full of people that know that every 2 years they might be out of a job. Yeah. How can you be happy? You go, are you happy? I don't know who's in charge.
Well, remember again, this is Harvard.
Yeah.
They know.
But no, they don't know. They're in Harvard. They haven't come down here. I bet nobody at Harvard has ever had a plate of grits. Okay? If they've had grits and sweet, and I know for a fact that they don't have sweet tea, because I was visiting my daughter in Massachusetts. I asked for sweet tea, and the woman looked at me like I was speaking, you know, Aramaic.
All right. So, look, let's get to the point here.
Uh-huh.
Look, number five is not bad. In a minute, we're going to talk about the unhappiest cities.
No, five isn't bad.
But what
we're
do? We look, we're a competitive city. We're a global city. We had the Olympics here in 1996. We have got to push our way up the list.
Oh, no, absolutely.
What do we do?
Well, I mean, first of all, I think we should be number four at the.
We should be ahead of Raleigh-Durham.
We should be ahead of Raleigh-Durham, and we should be number three.
We should be ahead of Washington, D.C.
Now, until we get a beach, we're not going to get number one. I mean, if we can somehow bomb Marietta and just expand Lake Allatoona so that we have the Atlanta seaside, that would be fabulous.
All right. So, Rob, I think of you as one of the happiest people I have ever known, and yet your individual happiness seems to have had no impact whatsoever on our rating. Are there people who we should ask to leave who might make us happier if they were gone?
Okay. Well... Yes. And I'm not profiling. Here are the people we need to get rid of to make everybody happier. People in a grocery line who seem surprised when they get to the checkout that they actually have to have money. And they will now get there, and all of a sudden when they say, that'll be $14.95, these people go, let me see if I have that. I'm sorry. Those people.
All right. Good start.
Okay. People that put their left blinker light on for miles.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just in case they want to turn.
That alone would move us to number four.
We're already. Get rid of the people in the grocery store and get rid of, you know, the people that are driving with the blinkers on. We're at three, mm-hmm. and we're closing in on two.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'd say we take all the people that we're going to get rid of, and we elect them to something that sends them to Washington. So we take all the people that make us miserable, send them to Washington, and then Washington automatically drops down.
So here's a question for you. Mm-hmm. You talk about beach towns.
Oh, yeah.
West Palm Beach and Boca Raton are beneath us. They're in the top 10, but they're number 9. Does that make sense to you?
Have you been to West Palm Beach?
I have been to West Palm Beach.
Okay. What did you notice on the beach at West Palm
Beach? Well, you tell me.
Okay. I'm not saying there should be an age limit for wearing a swimsuit. I mean, if you're still going to the ocean when you're 85 and you want to put on something to go swimming in, that's fine. But for men, there should be a cutoff for Speedos.
So that alone puts them below us.
Because they don't have a shoot on site for people in the Speedos, that's going to keep them. Every time you walk on the beach, you see, oh, no, I got to go back inside.
Yeah, they deserve to be below us. I got you.
Now, okay. See, what I don't understand is, and happy to say, Miami's not even on the list.
No, Miami is not
top
on
10.
The list.
And this is when they still had LeBron.
Yeah, yeah. Surprisingly, Cleveland has not moved up on the list since LeBron James.
You have to have LeBron, his clones, and the whole bunch of
folks. And they just won the Republican National Convention. That's got to make some people pretty darn happy.
Is that winning it, or do you just get it by default? I mean, this is a city whose river caught on fire, okay? When you have that in your history, your baseline for happiness can only go so high.
All right, well, look, they're not on either the happiest or unhappiest.
Happy or unhappiest.
So let's look at the unhappiest cities.
Okay.
This list has a number. I'm going to just show you the list. We'll post these, by the way, on the gpb.org website under Two-Way Street. Just go look at the worst, the unhappiest, and tell me if anything strikes you.
I have no problem with any of these little lists of this list. You know when?
We got Philadelphia, Buffalo, Las Vegas, St. Louis, Indianapolis, Detroit, Milwaukee, Louisville,
we got Louisville, Kentucky on there. You take Louisville out, what do you notice about the other nine?
They're all...
Are they in the South?
No, they're not in the South.
Are any of these take out Louisville? Can you go to any of those nine cities and order sweet tea?
I don't think you... Well, you might... That's right. If you take Louisville out, you're
take Louisville out, right. And I'm not sure why Louisville's on the list. Maybe they were just having a bad day. They're in the bluegrass state, and they noticed that they don't actually have any grass that is blue. That probably depresses them a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But everything else... I mean, come on. New York, Pittsburgh, Milwaukee, Detroit... How Detroit is number 5 and unhappy, I don't know.
Where would you put them?
Number 1. What if the city just went bankrupt? The whole city just said, we quit.
Buffalo, number 9.
Oh, that's no problem. Have you been to Buffalo in the winter?
I've been to Buffalo
in the winter. Time.
Yeah.
The only reason they're not higher is that they couldn't ask people because they were all, like, frozen.
Yeah, yeah. Philadelphia is number 10. The Philadelphia cheesesteak sandwich apparently did nothing to improve the happiness ratio there.
No, neither is calling that city the city of brotherly love. This is a city that once booed Santa Claus at a baseball game. Okay? This is Philadelphia, where they actually have a jail in their stadium.
Las Vegas is the 8th unhappiest city in the United States. gamblers who lose, I understand that. But residents of Las Vegas, don't you think it would be a happy place to live?
Who is a resident of Las Vegas? The people that work in the casinos, now they're fairly happy, but that's not the bulk of the people there. Mm-hmm. See, you got unhappy people there because people go there and lose all their money. They go, well, I'd go back home, but I got no money. I guess I'll stay and add to the unhappiness quotient of Las Vegas.
Rob, this is why I invite you in to explain these things.
No, that just makes sense.
All right, we got to get to the big one.
Okay.
This is the one I've been holding off on for the end. The number one unhappiest city in the United States of America, according to the University of British Columbia and Harvard University, is what?
New York, New York.
Come on.
I mean, first of all, it's not that they're unhappy. They just look unhappy. See, I think they were. I think the researchers from British Columbia, they went there and they went up to people in New York and they said, hey, are you happy? And what they got was, hey, oh. And so they said, oh, he must be unhappy. Then they went to somebody else and they said, are you happy here? Hey, happy, whoa, wait, what do you mean happy? And they said, okay, I take that as a no. That was that's why New York's on the list, because everybody they asked threatened to kill them. I mean, come on.
It's none of your darn business.
Right, but that's not fair. New York, I know very happy people in New York.
All right, so I'm looking over this list. Nashville is number 8 in the happiest cities list. Now, I have to tell you, I think Nashville is a wonderful city, and it worries me a little bit that as Nashville continues to grow culturally, economically, they could be challenging us at some point. What are the obstacles, in your expert opinion, that will keep Nashville from achieving higher ratings in the happiness quotient?
Graceland.
That's Memphis.
Okay.
You mean the fact they don't have Graceland?
They don't have Graceland. See, and now if Elvis had moved Graceland to Nashville, they would already be number
one. They'd be number one.
And as long as Graceland stays where it is, Nashville's going to stay where it is.
Well, Rob Cleveland, I'm delighted to get your expert feedback.
we are stretching the use of the word expert.
on the top 10 happiest and top 10 unhappiest cities in the United States, according to the University of British Columbia.
Now, bear in mind, number 10 on the happiest cities was Middlesex, New Jersey. We didn't even go there. Okay, we just leave that alone.
They just looked at the name.
They just looked at it and said, they got to be happy. And after our trip to New York, we'll give New Jersey. They must be happy. I mean, when you go to New Jersey and think that's happier, that's whoa, man.
Rob Cleveland is a storyteller and a humorist. He is also Two-Way Street's resident expert on everything funny. Rob, thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, thank you, Bill. And thank you, folks. Have a wonderful day. Happy day.
It's so important to make someone happy. Make just one someone happy.
That's it for our show this week. I hope you'll join me again next week at 4 for another edition of Two-Way Street. I'm Bill Nygut. Have a good week.